This morning we get back to our series of lessons from the book of 1 Timothy. So I'd invite you to be turning with me again to 1 Timothy, and we get back to our two-part kind of series within a series on the study of widows, the widows in the church. And as we get started, I would invite you to take another handout if you don't have yours with you this morning. They're on the front row, and feel free to just take one and pass it along. But this is the same handout from a few weeks ago. This is part two of that lesson. And if you're in the back room, there are some of those blue sheets on the table right under the window there. So feel free to make sure people back there have those as well. And we'll pick up with our study this morning that we left off a few weeks ago. But we started 3 weeks ago by noting that for most, if not all, of human history, women have lived longer than men. That is a fact. That is almost all cultures around the world. We looked at some reasons for this. There are some interesting reasons for this. And then we thought for a moment, if you remember, about what this means practically in terms of financial and emotional distress in the lives of widows as they experience the loss. And then we looked at 1 Timothy 5, verses 3 through 16. And as you can see on the handout, we started this two-part series with a summary of some categories or some scenarios that widows might find themselves in. And there are a number of categories outlined in this passage. And we started by looking at those who are widows indeed. And that term is used in verses 3, 5, and 16. And we learn that widows indeed are those women who are truly in need of help. And so these are Christian widows. We're not talking about everybody in the world here. We're talking about those among us, Christian widows who are legitimately destitute because of the loss that they have suffered. We then looked at the second category, widows with families, and we saw that in verses 4 and 8. And we learned that if a Christian widow has any children or grandchildren, those members of her own family have a moral and a God-given responsibility to step in and help this elderly woman in their family. As children, Paul explains that we have an obligation to make some return to our parents. That's the phrase that he uses. And so we learn that our parents take care of us for the first two decades of life. And old age is payback time. That's when we have the privilege of returning that favor. Then we looked at those Paul describes as wanton widows in verse 6. And wanton widows are those who are self-indulgent, living in luxury, living for pleasure. And obviously, these are not the widows who need the financial support of the church. Then we discussed the enlisted widows in verses 9 and 10. Those are the women who seem to have been recruited by the church, we might say, to serve their fellow widows. And Paul gives qualifications for those who would be called on to serve in this way. These women are not elders. They are not deacons. But the qualifications, as we discussed, are somewhat similar. Not in the technicalities of them, but just the idea of there being qualifications. They have been enlisted to serve the other widows. Paul then gives some words of advice to the younger widows in verses 11 through 15. And Paul's inspired suggestion is that the young widows need to go out there and get remarried and raise up children. They might be tempted to join the ranks of the full-time enlisted widows. However, Paul warns against taking that vow of chastity too early in life. And he says, it's not quite time for you to identify as a full-time widow. This is not your identity. You need to go out there, and his advice is to get remarried and have children. And then notice in the end, in verse 16, we have what we described as Lone Ranger widows. And it's not a bad thing, but these are the women who may or may not be qualified to serve with the enlisted, but they are helping widows on their own, and they're not necessarily even widows themselves. And so, again, Lone Ranger Christians, maybe elderly Christian women might be a better description here. And so as Paul brings some structure into this widow ministry in the church, and he corrects some abuses within it, he wants these women to know that you need to keep on doing what you're doing. Even though you may not meet the qualifications of the enlisted widows, you need to keep up the good work. Don't be just dumping your responsibility on the church that you're currently doing just because we have a more clearly defined ministry now. Keep on doing the good things. And we looked at Dorcas or Tabitha at the end of Acts chapter 9 as a good example of someone who is doing this. And so these are the scenarios that we discussed a few weeks ago. We had some inspired advice for women in these categories. And this morning I want us to look at this passage again. Only this time I want us to look at four very practical lessons. In other words, what does this passage really mean for us gathered together in this room? And so as we begin, let's all look together again at 1 Timothy chapter 5, verses 3 through 16. And let's keep our Bibles open as we study. We'll be looking at this passage back and forth this morning quite a few times. So 1 Timothy 5, verses 3 through 16. Honor widows who are widows indeed. But if any widow has children or grandchildren, they must first learn to practice piety in regard to their own family and to make some return to their parents, for this is acceptable in the sight of God. Now she who is a widow indeed and who has been left alone has fixed her hope on God and continues in entreaties and prayers night and day. But she who gives herself to wanton pleasure is dead even while she lives. Prescribe these things as well, so that they may be above reproach. But if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his own household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. A widow is to be put on the list only if she is not less than 60 years old, having been the wife of one man, having a reputation for good works, and if she has brought up children, if she has shown hospitality to strangers, if she has washed the saints' feet, if she has assisted those in distress, and if she has devoted herself to every good work. But refuse to put younger widows on the list, for when they feel sensual desires in disregard of Christ, they want to get married, thus incurring condemnation because they have set aside their previous pledge. At the same time, they also learn to be idle, as they go around from house to house, and not merely idle, but also gossips and busybodies, talking about things not proper to mention. Therefore, I want younger widows to get married, bear children, keep house, and give the enemy no occasion for reproach, for some have already turned aside to follow Satan. If any woman who is a believer has dependent widows, she must assist them, and the church must not be burdened, so that it may assist those who are widows indeed. As we look back at these 14 verses, I want us to notice again four very practical applications of this passage, four observations based on everything that we've read. And again, as you can see, I've labeled this as the so what section, as we sometimes do. And so the idea is, what does this passage really mean for us today? So we've looked at the categories of widows, the scenarios they find themselves in, but what does this mean for all of us? And the first practical lesson comes in the reminder that we as God's people, we have an obligation to care for our own. That's a good lesson, I believe, that comes from this entire passage. And we noted a few weeks ago, going back to verse 4, as I've alluded to this morning, old age is payback time. And so for those of us with older parents, we as their children, we have a moral obligation under God's law to make some return to our parents. They brought us into this world. They fed us. They clothed us. They gave us a place to live. They even taught us how to use a spoon. And now that they are old, we have the great privilege and the great honor of returning that favor. In commenting on this passage, someone suggested what we might do in return. They said, prepare a room for them. Receive them with as much joy as when they welcomed you at birth. Feed them, clothe them, love them, and hold them until the day you lay them in the grave. Isn't that an interesting summary of our responsibility as children? Even pagans and unbelievers understand how incredibly important this is. The Scottish commentator William Barclay reminds us that it was Greek law that sons and daughters were not only morally, but also legally bound to support their parents. Anyone who refused that duty lost his civil rights. I don't know if we can really picture that, if we can imagine the severity of that and what that really means. As an election official in the city of Madison, I'm thinking of the felon list that we have to check before we register anybody to vote. I don't know if all of you are familiar with that, but under law, felons are not allowed to vote until they're off paper, completely out of the system. And so we have a list that we have to check in order to make sure that people vote. In my neighborhood, I'm thankful there are not too many. I think there are 16 names on that list, 16, 1-6, and about half of those are the same person with 8 different aliases. And so there's this one guy that we really need to keep an eye out for. We're not allowed to allow him to register to vote. And so if that name is on the list, we have to turn them away until their voting rights are restored. But now for just a moment, imagine having another list. Not the felon list, but a list of those in the neighborhood who refuse to care for their aging parents. And they walk in the voting room, and I say, ah, you're here to vote. That's awesome. But let me check this list real quick. Ah, I see that you're on the list of those who have not been taking care of their parents. I'm sorry, but you will not be able to vote until you work that out. That's how serious it was in ancient Greece. That's what they said back in that time. They were not allowed to participate in civilized society. And so in ancient Greece, if you didn't take care of your mom and dad, you were not a part of that community. That was a serious issue. You are not worthy of participating in civilized society. The ancient philosopher Aristotle put it this way. It would be thought in the matter of food, we should help our parents before all others, since we owe our nourishment to them. And it is more honorable to help in this respect the authors of our being, even before ourselves. In other words, the way Aristotle saw it, it would be more honorable that we would starve ourselves than that we would allow our elderly parents to starve. That's what Aristotle thought many years before Christ. The ancient philosopher Plato said, next comes the honor of loving parents, to whom, as is proper, we have to pay the first and greatest and oldest of debts. Considering all which a man has belongs to those who gave him birth and brought him up, and that he must do all that he can to minister to them, first in his property, secondly in his person, and thirdly in his soul, paying the debts due to them for their care and travail, which they bestowed upon him of old in the days of his infancy, and which he is now able to pay back to them when they are old and in the extremity of their need. Those are some interesting quotes, I believe, from the ancient world and some of those old Greek philosophers. And you might be wondering, why is this gospel preacher quoting ancient philosophers? And the reason comes in verse 8. That's where Paul says, but if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his own household, he has denied the faith, and he is worse than an unbeliever. Since Paul references unbelievers, these ancient philosophers remind us what actual unbelievers thought about this. And Paul is saying that if we as God's people do not take care of our elderly parents, we are worse than those unbelievers. We are worse than men like Aristotle and Plato and the others, because they got it, and we need to get it as well. And if this is true of us as individuals, I would suggest, based on this passage, it is also true of us together as a church. As individuals and also as a congregation, we have an obligation to take care of our own. And as we just noted briefly a few weeks ago, this was one of the first challenges that was faced by the early church. It almost split the church, didn't it? You think about what happened there in Acts chapter 6, the Greek-speaking widows, they're being overlooked in the daily serving of food. And if we just let that sink in just a little bit, that tells us, first of all, that there was a daily distribution of food. That means the early church got together on a daily basis, and they made sure that they were all covered, that we all have enough to eat. Are we okay here? Let's get together and take care of the problem. So it shows us that first. But it also reminds us that sometimes we as God's people, we drop the ball. The early church dropped the ball there, didn't they? Because some of those widows, half the widows, were being ignored. And sometimes that happens in the Lord's church. We have the best of intentions, but sometimes we overlook things and we don't do things as well as we mean to. As I've said before, my grandfather often told me that the church is a perfect organization, but it's made up of imperfect people like us. It's made up of mere mortals, and so sometimes we blow it, and the early church certainly did. And so as a church, we don't always take care of the widows as we should. I didn't get any feedback from the back of the sheet, so I don't have any personal, you know, information from you, but I'm assuming that there are ways that we haven't done it as well as we could have in the past. And if that's the case, we need to fix it. And it reminds us that when we fail, we have a chance to make things right. Because in Acts chapter 6, they made it right. The apostles heard about this complaint. People were going hungry. They call on the church to find qualified men to fix it, and they fix it, and they get it done. And the Greek-speaking widows are fed. It was that important. Basically, the growth of the early church ground to a halt right at that point. You know, they weren't out preaching and teaching. They're like, we got to fix this. We got to make sure our people are cared for. We have an obligation to take care of our own. They fix it, and then they go out and they continue teaching and preaching. As we get back to applying this to our lives today, there is a second lesson. It comes in the reminder that God is deeply concerned how we take care of each other. God is deeply concerned about this. This is God's heart. In other words, God notices how we demonstrate our love for each other. I put verse 4 as a reference up here. Notice in verse 4, as we discussed a few weeks ago, we have the reference to piety, in the New American Standard at least. Piety is basically godly fear or respect. And so God then is deeply interested in how we treat each other. Caring for others is how we demonstrate our respect for God. If we are not caring for each other, if we are ignoring this issue, we are disrespecting God. We do not want to be in that situation. So we express our piety for God by how we take care of others. And God has always been concerned about this. This isn't just a verse here or there. This is all through Scripture. And I would invite you to keep a finger or something in 1 Timothy 5. And let's turn back just briefly to Deuteronomy 24. Deuteronomy 24, 17 through 22. This is on page 326 in our Pew Bibles, Deuteronomy 24, 17 through 22. We think back to the law of Moses, and these are the words from Deuteronomy 24, and we're reminded of how important all of this is to God. This is not a passing thought. This is who He is. He wants us to care for each other. Notice, please, Deuteronomy 24, 17 through 22. You shall not pervert the justice due to an alien or an orphan, nor take a widow's garment in pledge. But you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and that the Lord your God redeemed you from there. Therefore, I am commanding you to do this thing. When you reap your harvest in your field, and have forgotten a sheaf in the field, you shall not go back to get it. It shall be for the alien, for the orphan, and for the widow, in order that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. When you beat your olive tree, you shall not go over the boughs again. It shall be for the alien, for the orphan, and for the widow. When you gather the grapes of your vineyard, you shall not go over it again. It shall be for the alien, for the orphan, and for the widow. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I am commanding you to do this thing. And so we have in the law of Moses specific provisions for the poor. It was a practice known as gleaning. And some of us may be familiar with that. And they were to leave some of their crops in the field. They were to make a first pass with an intent to get everything. But as you know, if you harvest anything, it's easy to miss, especially green beans. Green beans are designed to be overlooked. Green beans are sneaky. And so the idea is, you know, go through the vineyard, go through the field. Go through, you know, shake the olive tree, but do it once and get what you can find. Get the first pass, but back away slowly and leave it there. And the reason is the poor were to be able to go back in and reap what was not taken. And I was thinking, so they could not go back. I was thinking, and I mentioned maybe a few years ago, but when I was little, the church in Crystal Lake, as I remember it, got a phone call saying, if you have any poor people, I've just harvested my cornfield over here. It was somewhere around McHenry County College. And he said, there's some corn left out in there in the field, and if you have any members who need it, feel free to come over. And I think that's the first time I realized we might have been poor, because our family, we reaped the harvest. We went back and picked some of the corn that that farmer had left there, and it was an interesting scenario. And you know what also that does? It lets those who are poor be a part of it. Notice that God doesn't say, reap absolutely everything and then hand 10% over it to the poor. And you think there's a value to that? The poor are invested in that. They have to go out there. Even though they're not landowners, they have to do something to get that benefit. And so that was the law under the law of Moses. And just thinking about God's law, generally speaking, laws in general keep us from hurting other people. Most laws are things like, you know, don't kill, don't steal, don't do damage. But God's law has always gone beyond that, with some positive commandments. So not only are we not to hurt strangers and aliens and orphans and widows, but we are to take some positive steps to make sure that they're cared for. And twice in this passage we just read, God gives the reason, doesn't he? God does not always give the reason for every law that he gives, but here we have one. They were to care for those in need because they themselves had at one time been slaves in the land of Egypt. And so God is saying, since I helped you, you had better go out and help others. You need to show them what I've shown you. And if that was true then, it's also true today. And that's why we read James 1:27 as our scripture reading a few weeks ago. Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this: to look after, that is, to care for orphans and widows in their distress, and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. If we want to keep ourselves unstained by this world, I don't want to be stained by this world. If we don't want that, then we need to go above and beyond in caring for those who may not be able to care for themselves. We help others because He helped us. And so He is deeply concerned with how we care for others. There is a third practical lesson from this passage in 1 Timothy. It comes in another reminder that widows themselves, and really all of the elderly in general, may play a critical role in helping others, in helping each other. And this goes back to our discussion of the enlisted a few weeks ago in verses 9 and 10. And as we went into greater detail then, it seems that Paul was helping Timothy maybe recruit some of these well-qualified older women with a history of service, giving them some responsibility in reaching out and helping the other widows. And so I put on the wall up here, widows helping widows. So I'm thinking some kind of a widow ministry, but it's not limited to that. We're widening this up. Notice, even among those who are on the receiving end, though, notice in verse 5, even those getting help, notice we find there that they are to be women who continue in entreaties and prayers night and day. How important is prayer in the life of a congregation? Just critically important. And maybe the widows, or somebody stuck at home, or somebody restricted because of their movement or old age, may not be able to do everything that everybody else may be able to do. But notice here, they are being called on and commanded to pray. That's one thing that they need to do. And I'm thinking maybe our members who are in their 40s or 50s at the peaks of their career, they're out there working 60, 80 hours a week, whatever it is, they may not have the ability to go to God in prayer as often as they might wish. But there are some people in the congregation who are able to do that, and Paul calls on them here. I would also point out that even the recipients of the help, they are not really to be considered some kind of charity case. It's not, oh, poor you, we're giving you this to take care of you. They have a role in this. And so there is an obligation, there is something that they are being called on to do, playing a vital role in the church, and reaching out, praying constantly to God on behalf of others. But even widening it out beyond just the widows, more of a general principle here, we certainly also find that those who are older in general, not just the widows, all have so much to offer, visiting in homes and hospitals. And again, for our members who are working 60 hours a week, you may not be able to go to UW Hospital and sit with somebody during surgery for 8 hours. But there are some members of our congregation who do decide to do that, and they do have the ability to do that. You think that has an impact on the world around us when they see Christian people gathering around other Christian people in need? Absolutely, that word gets out. Maybe giving advice to those who are younger, teaching God's word in various ways, not even in the Bible class program, offering to watch the children so a young Christian couple can get away for an evening. I remember years ago, there was a couple older than us here at this congregation, and they were so incredibly helpful with that. And they pulled us aside one Sunday and they said, you know, you got two little kids and I know your anniversary is coming up. How about if you two kids go out and we'll take your kids for the night? Oh, that is so cool. And so that was two older members of this congregation who stepped in and helped in that way. When we were first starting to have children, you know, we faced a decision as young potential parents. You know, we can move to be closer to our parents. You know, her parents had lived in Alaska and then Ohio, mine down in Illinois. We could move to be with them, or we could lean on our Christian family. And there were a number of older members here who stepped in, and we consider them in many ways to be adopted grandparents to our children, and we're so thankful to that. Some of our hardest workers at Bible camp are retired. And I would put retired in quotes. They are not retired from the Lord's service. Absolutely not, but they've come out of secular work. We have a retired county jailer. Boy, he's awesome with the kids. any conflict resolution, this guy can cut through it in a way that is just amazing. If you figure out who hit who, man, this guy gets it solved and comes to an awesome resolution in a good, calm, gentle way that I'm just not able to do. But they have not bought into the world's way of thinking about retirement as a time to slack off and relax and, you know, coast off into the sunset playing shuffleboard on a resort in Florida. You know, that's not what these people are doing. But they have dedicated their lives to helping others. We had two members of our staff this week who volunteer with the Sojourners. And I don't know if you're familiar with the Sojourners. You should look that up if you can. They represent a group of thousands of Christian seniors who travel across the U.S. in motorhomes and RVs, volunteering their time and talent to help out at small churches and Christian camps and children's homes and orphanages in so many other ways. What an awesome retirement that would be. You know, you get to travel in your RV, but wherever you go, you plug in and you help at a Bible camp for a week. Then you unplug and you go to the next one. And then you go to some church in Minnesota and paint the building for a week or whatever. And so they're using their senior years in that way. But what an awesome thing to do. I should have talked with Clint before, but I was thinking of Chuck and Kathy Opperman. And some of you remember when they were here and Chuck retired, I believe he was a pipe fitter up in at John Deere northeast of here, and I thought it was maybe even in his 50s. And so he retired at a fairly early age. He could have retired, and he could have spent the rest of his life, you know, by the pool at some retirement community somewhere, but he didn't do that. Some of you remember that he went back to school, attended the Florida School of Preaching for a couple years, learned how to be a preacher, and moved back to Wisconsin and served the church in Beaver Dam honorably for several years, bringing good, solid Bible teaching, a good example, some good encouragement to that strong congregation. They've since moved south again, but he and Kathy, as I understand it, continue to be heavily involved in the work of the church down there. But the point here is widows and really the elderly in general play an absolutely huge role in helping others. We are not to waste our retirement years doing nothing. And that seems to be one lesson that we can get from this passage. So we come to the end of this passage and this lesson, and I would also just briefly point out that the Christian faith is incredibly practical. What we believe changes the way we live. And if it doesn't, we shouldn't even be believing it. I mean, that's how serious it is. And what I mean by this is what Paul is implementing here will change lives in the church in Ephesus. As you look at this whole passage, the Apostle Paul, he is giving guidelines that will ease the burden on the church. It seems that they were being overwhelmed, and so he's dividing this up. He does this by mobilizing a significant population within the congregation to get busy in an effective way. He then enlists the senior widows, puts them into service, perhaps coordinating this ministry. At the same time, he demands that Christian families take care of their own. That right there is huge. And then notice he makes sure that those on the receiving end are also involved in the life and the work of the church. Again, imagine what impact this would have had on the people in Ephesus. In a harsh world, the pagan community would look at the church and they would realize these people take care of their own. These people take care of their own, and I want to be a part of that. I want that kind of love. I want to enjoy that fellowship. And that right there is the reason for so much of what we do as individuals and also as a group here at this congregation. As we sometimes say, we want to do the very best that we can to be Jesus to the world around us. We want to go out in the community of Madison and these surrounding areas, and we want to do for others what Jesus would do. We want to care for people. We want to be genuinely interested and do what needs to be done. In this case, it means that we take care of our own. Love is practical. Our faith changes the way we live. And as was read in our scripture reading this morning, 1 John 3:16 through 18, we know love by this, that he, that is Jesus, laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. But whoever has the world's goods and sees his brother in need and closes his heart against him, how does the love of God abide in him? Little children, let us not love with word or with tongue, but in deed and truth. And with this, we come to the end of this passage on widows. We've looked at several scenarios that the women in Ephesus might have found themselves in. We've looked at Paul's instructions for those women. And then today, we've looked at what this means for us. As we close, we want to give everybody here the invitation to obey the gospel. to respond to the grace of God that we discussed in our Bible class this morning, the sacrifice of His Son. In response to His death, burial, and resurrection, we turn away from sin. We understand what sin is. We don't want anything to do with it. We confess Jesus as being the Son of God, and then we allow ourselves to be buried with Christ for the forgiveness of our sins. At that point, we are added to His kingdom. We become a part of a worldwide family. The Christian life begins. And if you have any questions about that, we'd love to talk with you. But if you're ready to obey the gospel right now, you can let us know as we stand and sing. Let's all stand and sing together.